at least someone wrote to me asking about credit for the course. So I think of graduate courses usually as different from undergraduate courses, so I don't set midterms or final exams. And I also will not hand out official homework assignments aside from the exercises I assign in class, and I fully expect you to think about just to understand what we are doing. However, if you want to have qualified credit for it or you need it for your home university, then just talk to me, and I would suggest we structure it around some reading project. I'll give you something to read, and then you can report back either to me or to the whole class for that. So if you're interested in this, just let me know. Okay, we finished last time with the notion of limits and co-limits. And so start out today by elaborating a little bit on these concepts. So recall the basic setup. So we are given I, a small index category, and that's why it's called I. F, so C, any category. And F from I to Y, I to C, the functor. And then we also said that given such a small category and the category C, so for every object X and C, we have sort of the constant functor on X from I to C, which simply maps any object A and I to the object X, and any morphism to the identity on X. So this is the constant functor value X. And then we'll say that so we'll define, first of all, the inverse limit over I of F as a pre-sheath, so as a functor from C up to sets, which to any X in the objects of C assigns a set hom over the functor category from I to C, the morphisms from CX to F. So this is the abstract, if one wants, the abstract limit, or sometimes in the literature it's also called the inverse limit of F. But it's important to remember that this is as a pre-sheath. And one says that the inverse limit over I of F exists if this functor is representable. So let me recall what that means. So in other words, there exists some object Z in C such that, and so I'll develop it from first principles. So first of all, that this functor is representable means that the functor represented by Z, that is hom C blank Z, is isomorphic to lim inverse over I of F as pre-sheaths. Now, recall that the morphisms between two such functors, a representable one and an arbitrary one, are in one-to-one correspondence with the elements. So remember Yoneda's lemma, morphisms. The morphisms of functors hum, or pre-sheafs, if you like, hum z to g are in one-to-one correspondence with the elements in g of z. So in particular, if we have such an isomorphism here, so that is a particular element, so let's call this isomorphism something, alpha. So alpha is uniquely determined by an element, let's call it alpha twiddle, in lim inverse I f of z. And what is this? Well, by definition, this is the same thing as a homomorphism of functors between functors from I to C, from the constant functor on z to the functor f. So in other words, how does such a thing look like? So alpha tilde will assign to each object A and I a morphism from the value of the constant functor on A to f of A. However, this is simply the object z itself, because C index z is a constant functor. And for any morphism, so from A to F, A to B, given by, let's say, my alphabet is always too small. A nice letter here. Well, let's call it F. We have to have a commutative diagram like so. But because, again, CZ is a constant functor, so we know that these objects are both equal to Z, and here we have the identity. So in other words, and that's sort of the expanded version, alpha corresponds to a family of morphisms in C, one for each morphism in I, namely what we called here. So we have Z, alpha twiddle A goes to F of A, alpha twiddle B goes to F of B, and here we have F of F. So the family corresponds to a family of morphisms in C, namely the family alpha twiddle A index A, such that for each F, the morphism in I, this little triangle commutes. So this is just writing down what it means that we have a morphism from a constant functor to F. It does not yet express what it means to have an isomorphism here. But so let's look back what it means that this functor is representable. Well, what it clearly means is that if we have any other constant functor, So what is the distinguishing feature of Z together with this family alpha twiddle A in the objects of I? Well, again, we'll just look what it means that it represents a center. So if I evaluate what I just said before for this set here, for the constant functor from X to F, so that means that I have a family, let's call it beta of A, F of A, F of B, F of F. So beta of B. So assume given commutative triangle, so assume given X comma beta A and I, and the objects of I, such that each of these triangles commutes. So each and each means, of course, for each morphism F in I, then, well, if you look at the defining property, so on this side, we are given an element of the inverse limit over F of F over I evaluated at X. That's such a family. And what we want is that this should be the same as Hom from X to C in the category X to Z in the category C. So in other words, we want, sorry for this here, we want that there exists some morphism from X to Z such that the canonical maps so there exists a unique morphism, shall we call it, capital F is used already, G, let's say. So there exists a unique morphism, G, from X to Z in C, such that beta A equals alpha twiddle A composed with G for each A in R. So one way of reading this is to say that given this whole functor, which you can think of as a gigantic diagram, it assigns an object for each object in I and morphisms for each morphism in F. There's sort of a closest element in C closest related to this diagram, right? If whenever you have any other morphism into these diagrams, so that such that the outer triangles commute, then there exists a unique morphism to this closest object, Z, such that everything here, so that in this subdivision, all three tiny triangles commute. So this is just spelled out in gruesome detail what it means that the inverse limit of the functor F exists. So there exists an object in C which is sort of the closest approximation to this whole diagram. For any other morphism, family of morphisms into this diagram, there exists a unique morphism in C. Yeah? Now, I know, but if you see this for the first time, it looks terrible. So what does it mean in practice? So let's do a few examples. And I'm going to give you three examples, and as we will see in a moment, these are really the key examples. These are the ones you need to know, and if you know them most of the time, you get everything else from there. So the first example is where I is discrete. So remember what that means. That means that I is essentially just a set. The only morphisms are the identity morphisms. So i.e., I is a set with only identities as morphisms. Well, you see, that makes the situation quite a bit simpler because now we don't have to worry about any diagrams anymore because there are no real morphisms, just the identities. So what is then a functor? So a functor F from I into some category C is what? Just a family of objects in the indexed by I. So it's nothing but a family of objects indexed by the set I, which happens to be the same, which will identify with the objects because the category is discrete. So, in other words, F is just the same thing as a collection of objects in C indexed by I. Now, let's look what it means. So what is, first of all, so given some y in the objects of C, what is this functor, inverse limit of f over I, evaluated on y? Well, if you look at what we said here, it means that for the object y, you have to give a morphism into each of the individual objects f of a. So in other words, this set, lim inverse over I of f at y, is the same thing as the set of all families of morphisms y goes to xa indexed by a. And how shall we call this thing here? Well, let's call it fa. So fa from y to xa morphisms morphism in C. Or, if you like, if you write it as sort of, again, this is indexed by A, so we can think of this as being the product over all A and I. Maybe to be certain, I write the objects of I, even though in for a discrete category doesn't really matter, and then we are given one morphism in C from Y to XA for each A. So on the level of sets, so you see, if you think of this as being a functor in Y, on the level of sets, this is nothing but taking the product over all these hom sets into the members of the family. So, if the limit exists, one writes it, one writes a representing object, not surprisingly, as product over A and I, XA. Now again, watch out, because this is where in most textbooks or in the literature or so, the next point is usually skipped over because it is understood. However, it is crucial. remember what this means. This means that not only do we have the situation here that there is an object which is closest sort of to this family, but we also have particular morphisms to the individual values of the functor. So if this is our Z, so then the morphisms, well, let's see what they are. So alpha tilde A, which would go from Z, which we denoted as the product, to XA. So these are called the projections of the projection onto the factor XA. And so they are also usually written as simply PA or PXA or whatever have you, whatever is convenient in the situation. And these morphisms in C satisfy, well, what? Well, now we just look back at this diagram. So we have the projection onto the A's factor, and the statement is, if we are given any family, so for any family of morphisms Y to XA indexed by A, let's call them QA, there exists a unique morphism Q from Y to the product over the X alpha, or XA, sorry, such that this diagram here commutes for every, such that star commutes for every. So the crucial thing I want to hammer home is existence of such a limit is not just the question of the existence of such an object. It always is this object plus the morphisms, sort of the canonical morphisms into the diagram. So it is really, you need really both things are needed. Now, we had various categories last time, and let me just run through a few of them. So, for example, we have the category sets itself. So, do products exist? Or which kind of products exist? Well, if I have a family of sets, and I take the product of those sets with the canonical projections, this is the corresponding object. So all products exist. And if you say something like this, it is always understood. Because remember, we only define this for small index categories. So what this is saying, all products exist, but what is implicit here is that these products are indexed by a set. So that you don't run into this trouble of indexing over, say, the set of all sets or something like this. No, only if you want this not to be empty. How about groups? So I give you a family of groups. Can you construct a product? Well, Obviously, you can, and it's actually the same thing as the underlying set theoretic product, because it carries a natural group structure and has automatically and satisfies the property. So I look at the category of abelian groups. Well, same thing, right? So what we are seeing here is some that the product, even though we are in different categories, there is sort of a universal construction in the category of sets, and it automatically gives you the right thing in these two. For example, would be the same also if you do it in the category of rings or the category of commutative rings. It still is the same construction. Just take the set theoretic product and we'll do. Okay, now you say, well, what the heck, eh? Now let's look. Let's say we look at the category of finite groups. What's the situation there? What's your guess or educated answer? Do arbitrary products exist in the category of finite groups? No. Well, several people are shaking their heads in disbelief, yes. So what kind of products do exist? Finite products, yes. So only finite, and this means equals indexed by a finite set product exist, and then they are again given by the same procedure. Just take the direct product of the underlying sets. So here is an example where only a particular type of product exists. Now here is something which is slightly more tricky. Remember, we had looked at, say, an associative monoid, and then we had assigned to it its classifying category. And remind you, this is just the category which has one object, and the morphisms are simply given by the monoid M. Maybe I shouldn't put set brackets around it. Doesn't make sense, does it? Now, here's a question. What kind of product exists in BM? Well, let's see. So assume you're given I, a discrete category, so then again the functor f from I to bm is simply, so these functors are simply in one-to-one correspondence with collections of objects. Well, how does a collection of objects look like? Well, there is only one object, so this is just the single object, but counted once for each object A and I. Now, does a product over this exist, or in which conditions? Hmm? I don't know. Well, let's write down the definition. So what would be the limit over I of f, say, evaluated at some object? Well, there is only one object. So let's see what is this evaluated as the unique object that exists. Well, by what was said somewhere, I think it's just probably hidden here, yep, this is the same thing as the product over all A and I of BM from this dot into the same dot, one for each A. So in other words, this is the product over A and I of simply the monoid M. And so the question is, can this be isomorphic to over C, which is B of M, from some object to some object, to from this object to something? Well, we know that the only choice for something is the single object itself. But this is the monoid M. So under which circumstances are these two the same? For example, so, yes, so exists if, for example, I has exactly one object, fine, or if M has one object, if M, cardinality of M equals 1. And in all other cases, it doesn't. So, we can make this if and only if. All right. Now, even though it can be argued that I don't need to do the next step because it's just a dual of what we just did, however, I still want to say, let's say we have a functor f from I to C, and I want the direct limit of I of f. Good point. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, I was jumping ahead. Thank you. Good to have you in the audience. Yeah. So the second example, well, I start with the baby example. So the real second example is to come in a moment. Assume I is the category which belongs, if you like, to the ordered set with linearly ordered set with two elements. So I have just one object, I have two objects and one arrow, non-identity arrow. Now, so the one morphism category. Or, if you like to think of it in terms of pre-ordered sets, this is just the classifying category of the linearly partially ordered set 0 is less than 1. Yeah? Okay, so let's see arbitrary category. So what is the functor f from I to C? It's just nothing but picking out a morphism, right? Because I need to assign an object to this object, I need to assign an object to this object, and I need to assign a morphism to the unique morphism I have. So in other words, the functors from I to C is the same thing as the morphisms in C. And of course, pay attention, not that I lose usage of set theoretical brackets, because I didn't say that C was small. So there might not be a set. But I could be more precise. I could define, so here's a definition, more C, the morphism category of C is by definition the set of morphisms from the category I to C. So this is again a category, and its objects are the morphisms. By the way, what are the morphisms between the morphisms? So I have one functor which assigns the morphism F. I have a second functor which assigns the morphism G, not necessarily between the same two objects. What is the morphism of these two functors? Well, remember the abstract definition. For each object in the domain, I need to give a morphism between the images under the two functors. So here's F of dot, and here's G of dot. And so I need to give a morphism between the two. So this would be the morphism which belongs to the dot. Similarly, I need, so this is F of star is Y, and G of star is Y prime. And so a morphism between these functors, I have to give a morphism A of star, such that for any morphism in the domain, and there is only one, this diagram commutes. So in other words, the morphisms between morphisms are nothing but the commutative squares. So the morphisms of morphisms are commutative squares. Okay. Now, we've come to the real question. So what should be the inverse limit of such a functor? So I give a functor from this one morphism category to C. What's its inverse limit? So here we have F, which consists of a morphism from X to Y. It's the same thing. So what would it mean? What's the inverse limit? Well, it should be an object such that there exists sort of two morphisms, alpha X, alpha Y, one into sort of over the object dot, one over the object star, making this diagram commutative. And it should have the property that for any object y, if you take the identity from y to y, y is already spoken for, so let's take u. If I have a morphism here, let's call it beta x, and I have a morphism here, call it beta y, there exists unique morphism gamma here, and there exists a unique morphism gamma prime here, so that everything nicely commutes. Now, this is a grandiose overstatement. What's going on here? What should I take for z? For any u, and I better say any beta x, beta y, making the outer, well, it's not really a square, let's say a keg, commute, there exists unique morphisms gamma, gamma prime, such that this triangle here commutes, and this triangle commutes. So now let's reduce this to its real content. So tell me what I know about the various morphisms that appear here in this picture. Well, for example, I certainly know right away the gamma is equal to gamma prime, right? Because of this commute. What do I know about alpha what? From this diagram. So if I give a pair alpha x, alpha y, such that the upper square commutes, what does it mean for alpha y? Yeah, of course, it's just f composed with alpha x. And so now I want that no matter which morphism I give from u to z, from u to x, it factors through alpha x. What should I take as alpha x? So what should be alpha x? So that I can satisfy these conditions. Well, look. I mean, if I take z to be x itself, if I take u equals x, and I take the identity here, I have to be able to factor through alpha x. So I claim the solution is very simple. We simply take alpha x equal, we take z equal to x, alpha x equal to the identity on x, alpha y equal to f. So in other words, the inverse limit over the arrow category of the arrow x, f, y is simply x. Not very deep, just a very complicated way of expressing things. So this was a baby example. Now the better example is if I take two morphisms. I take as I the category which has two objects and two morphisms. So what's a functor? F from I to C. Well, again, this consists simply of an object in C, which is the image of dot, and another object, which is the image of star, and two morphisms between X and Y. So now, what will it mean to say that the inverse limit exists? So I'll give you a hint through the definition how these things are called. So if the limit, and I'll write it x, f, g, y exists, it is called the equalizer of f and g. And now I ask you to explain to me why you would call this inverse limit the equalizer of the two morphisms. Well, let's look what a morphism from a constant functor value z will be. Now again, because I have identities down here, it's the constant functor, everything is determined by what happens on the first component. So if I have some morphism here, well, what morphism can I put here? Well, first of all, it means that f of h, so if I just look at the upper arrows, then I see that I have no choice but to put fh here. If I look at the lower arrow, I see that I have no choice but to put gh there. So for this to be commutative, it must be that fh equals gh. So in other words, what this means is that HOM C, well, could say it this way, so that lim, the inverse limit over this diagram of x, f, g, y, evaluated on z, is nothing but the set of all morphisms h from z to x, such that fh equals gh. And this is indeed a set because we have inside a fixed morphism set, and that is a set. So now you see why it's called the equalizer, because on every object, it picks out those morphisms into the source of this pair such that the morphism gets equalized by f and g, fh equals gh. Now let's see. Assume C equals the category of sets. So we have two sets, we have two maps, F and G to Y. Does the equalizer of F and G exist? And if so, how does it look like? So lim, the inverse limit over x, f, g, y will be the set of all x and x such that f of x equals g of x. So it's a subset of x where the two maps coincide. And I should better write here, it's isomorphic because, remember, representing objects are only defined up to isomorphism. So this is, of course, now an exercise to check this, that this indeed has a required universal property. But it is clear, right? If I have any map from a set Z to X such that FH equals GH, well, in particular means that F and G have to coincide on the image of Z, on H of Z, which means that H of Z is contained in this set here, and the inclusion is the universal map to this set. Was that too fast? Good. All right. So this is the equalizer. The equalizer is not very popular for whatever reason. But there is one particular example you all know, and which has a special name. So assume the category C has a zero object E. Remember what that means. It means that for any X There is a unique morphism to E, that's to say that E is final, and also for any Y, there exists a unique map from E to Y, which means that E is initial, and so to, if it's final and initial, that's the same thing as to say it's a zero object. So then, we call this simply the zero map. So write it E or zero, whatever you like. And so then the equalizer of X, F, Y, and the map E, this unique defined map E, this is also called the kernel of F. Now, of course, everybody knows what this is in terms of for groups and so on, so let's try sets. First of all, does a category of sets have a zero object? Is the empty set a zero object for the category of sets? No. Why not? Because you never can have a map to the empty set. You only have maps from the empty set. So the initial object in the category of sets is the empty set, but the final object is the one element set. So they are distinct, so there is no zero object. How can I fix this? Just look at the category of sets with base point. Right? So let's look at sets star, which we define to be sets with base point. So an object is simply a pair X together with a distinguished point, and the morphisms are just the maps of sets which map the distinguished points to themselves. Okay, so if I have the map F from one pointed set to another, what is the kernel? Well, if you look at the definition, a description of the equalizer, so here we have really two maps. We have one, which is a given map F from X to Y, and we have the other one, which collapses everything to a point and then embeds it into the base point of Y. So what is the equalizer here? Or the kernel? Huh? Yeah, it's just a fiber over the distinguished point of F. And so kernels are much more popular than equalizers. However, the other reason why equalizers are not so terribly popular is because you always can write them in a different way. Even though at first glance it looks like we make life more complicated, namely, this is sort of the real case too. Let's look at the category I, which has three objects and two morphisms. And so what is a functor on this category? Well, it's clearly just pairs of morphisms which have the same target, same codomain, same range, whatever you call it. What are the morphisms between two such functors? So if I have a functor G, which is given by X prime, Y prime, Z prime, F prime, G prime, what will be a morphism? Well, mind you, morphism means I have to give a morphism over each of the objects in the base. So in other words, I have a morphism from Y to Y prime, from X to X prime, and from Z to Z prime, so that all things that reasonably can commute do commute. In particular, so we have, let's call this A, B, C. So we have to have that CF equals F prime A and CG equals G prime B. So, what kind of gadget will be the inverse limit? So, definition again. The inverse limit of such a functor is called, and that various, unfortunately, terminology is not unique, is called the fiber product of F and G. This is sort of totally correct, but nobody says that. It's called the fiber product of X and Y over Z. So the objects are considered to be important, not the morphisms, which is a big mistake, but what can we do? And it's also sometimes called the pullback of X and Y, or FG over Z. So there are different notations, either called the fiber product or pullback. So the pullback is sort of slightly more dynamic terminology. Well, I come to this in a second. This is where things really... So what does it mean that the inverse limit, and again, I'll just, if I can do it, because the diagrams are so small, I'll just write down the whole function. So what's the inverse limit of this diagram? Well, again, let's see what happens if I evaluate on an object U. Well, it would mean that I take the constant functor. So I take U everywhere and the identities in between. I take X, Z, Y. And then, for any SOHOM, so this thing would be consists of all the triples A, B, C, such that this diagram commutes, i.e., so it's a set of all A, B, C, such that this commutes, that is, which conditions do we have to satisfy? Well, we have to satisfy that C equals FA. This comes from this first diagram, and the second square says that GB equals C. Or, in other words, we can combine these two, FA equals GB. So in other words, again, as we saw in an earlier example, this morphism C here is not really relevant, right? It's determined by the rest. So in other words, if you look at our little diagram, then what does it mean that the fiber product exists? And so the fiber product is usually written as X cross Y over Z. So then, because the natural isomorphism, what we called earlier, alpha, so you have to have morphisms here and here, and they are again called the projection, either the first projection or the projection on X. This here would be the second projection or the projection on Y, which has the property that if I have any U and I have a morphism, as before, A and B, such that the outer diagram commutes, so with FA equals GB, then there exists a unique morphism here, H. There exists a unique morphism H from Z to X, from U to X cross Y over Z, such that the projection onto X, H followed by the projection onto X equals A, and the projection onto Y, which combined with H, equals B. And sometimes there's various notations. So in some books it's written like this. So just to indicate that this square represents the fiber product of these two morphisms. Sometimes in some books you put a square in there, and that means it's a Cartesian square. So such a square is also called Cartesian square, or a pullback diagram. And now what Drawer was saying about pullback along, well, sometimes, you see, you want to pay attention to F and not to G. So then sometimes one sets these morphisms, one writes them as F prime, G prime, and then one says that F prime is the pullback of F along G, and G prime is the pullback of G along F. So that depends very much on... what is the context? It depends on whether both morphisms in your diagram have the same sort of importance, or whether one of the two, F and G, is more important than the other in what you are just doing. So sometimes, let's say F prime, which would be equal to PY equal P2, is called the pullback of F along G, or the morphism obtained from F by base change along G. And again, in this case, one sort of thinks of this being a morphism from something to some base, and then one fiddles with the base and asks whether one can pull back the given family. So, example. Well, again, in sets. Does a pullback of two morphisms exist or not, and what is it? So in the category of sets, sort of the inverse limit of X, F, Y, Z, Y, G, is simply the set of all pairs, X, Y, such that F of X equals G of Y. So it is the ordinary fiber product of two morphisms of sets, two maps of sets. Now what is it in category of groups? Same thing, right? Because it inherits a group structure. Same in the category of abelian groups. Same in the category of rings, or commutative rings. How about finite groups? Why not, right? Because the product of two finite groups is still finite. So, makes sense there. Okay, so... Thank you. Lemma. Well?
Does the equalizer exist for a general group? It doesn't. For abelian, it exists. But general group,
Ah, good? Okay. Yes, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. This was exactly my mistake in the first lecture, right? Remember? So here's drawer's example. So example, in groups, in the category of groups, what is the equalizer of two group homomorphisms, let's call them phi and psi, from G to G prime? Does it exist or not? So what is it if it exists? So, let's see. Well, we run arbitrary groups, not abelian ones. Or something. So what is wrong? What is wrong if I simply say, declare H to be the set of all G and G such that phi of G equals psi of G? That's what it was for sets, right? Remember, that's what you said for sets. It is this. I have two maps of sets, and the equalizer was just a set of points in the domain where the two maps coincided. So why isn't that fine here? Okay. Fine or not? So what's the real question here? The real question is simply, is this a group? Because if it is a group, then it automatically will have a correct property, because it does so as a set. So is this a group or not? Well, if I have G and H in H, all I need to ask is whether GH inverse is an H, right? Is it or not? No problem, right? I mean, I have phi of GH inverse equals phi of G, phi of H inverse, because phi is a homomorphism, because phi of G is the same as psi of G, and phi of H is the same as psi of H. So I have the G times H inverse is again in there. So does the equalizer exist or not? Answer is yes, it does. So equalizer exists. No problem.
The only reason it's so fundamental that there must be places where it's used.
Well, yes and no. Just a second. What is the confusion is, of course, if these were abelian groups, then somebody said take phi minus G, phi minus psi, right? So if, and that's a crucial difference, so if G, G prime are in the category of abelian groups, then the equalizer of phi and psi is isomorphic to the kernel of phi minus psi, using that phi minus, so assuming that the groups are written additively, right? Because then in for abelian groups, the difference of two morphisms is again a morphism, which is false for arbitrary groups. So, but the kernel of phi and psi for arbitrary group homomorphisms does not make sense, because we cannot shift it over. Right? We cannot shift this to there, because phi times psi inverse is not a group homomorphism. Okay, so let me answer Dror's last question. Well, yeah. Here's a lemma, and then we'll break for take a short break. I'll let you think about this. So lemma: let f from x to y and g from x to y be morphisms in C, then the equalizer of F and G is isomorphic to the Cartesian product or pullback. I think I didn't even say it was also called the Cartesian product or fiber product of the diagram X, F, Y, X, G, provided, and this is a big proviso, So the question is, first of all, what does it mean? Because I didn't say that these things exist, so I should say, maybe as a cautionary note here, as pre-sheaves on C. So I do not necessarily require that the objects, these functors, are representable. I say they're already isomorphic as pre-sheaves. So if one of them is representable, so then is the other, and the representing objects are isomorphic. And so that answers your question about groups, because you don't need the equalizer. You can always express it as a fiber product. The proof is really not difficult, so I'll give you 10 minutes to think about it, and then we'll continue.